Mormon women will read from their work the fiction, creating the fictional world as they see it. And we have three wonderful readers. We have two so far. We hope our third one comes. Pauline Mortensen will be reading first. This is her first book. It's called Back Before the World Turned Nasty. And it's a wonderful book of short stories. She said she began writing because no one ever wrote stories about people like her family. And she wanted to see fiction about people like her and her family. And they're really excellent stories. They're wonderful. She's also working on a new book. She told me that the title is Naked in the North Woods, or is it North in the Naked Woods? And she decided it was North in the Naked Woods because it's the more ambiguous, meaningful title. She also works at Word Perfect, and she's the mother of a 5-year-old monster, as she calls him. Our second reader will be Julie Nichols, and she is working on her dissertation at the University of Utah Fiction Writing Program. She's ABD. She says working on the dissertation is a long and slow process. She is the mother of four, and her husband is in Provo today. And she, I have always thought of Julie as an original thinker who brings both intellect and heart to what she does, to everything I've ever heard her create or read. And we will enjoy hearing from her. Our third reader, who we hope will be arriving shortly, is Margaret Young. Her first book is this novel, House Without Walls, that was published by Deseret Book. Her second is Salvador, which is, we think, published by Aspen Book, and she also has a book of short stories coming out very soon. She is also a mother of four and lives in Provo, Utah, and works in Provo, Utah. And all three of these people are wonderful writers, and it's going to be a treat to hear from them, so we will just turn the time over to them.
The True Story of Elma the Egg. The girl called Elma stood on the rickety blue table, her back to the wall, trying not to put her weight on her right foot. She had been standing there for as long as she could remember, for as long as it took Miss Floss to decide how many minutes she had to stand for talking out loud, for as long as it took the everlasting cold to creep in under her dress. Outside, the wind had been blowing all morning and the snow piling in half-moon circles in the window panes. If this kept up, Elma and Tress would be hard put to make it across the Talbots' field, and they would have to go miles around by the road. Olivia Talbot had said it was much closer to her house anyway, and why didn't they stay overnight there and they could play rats and snakes all night? That was when Miss Floss had lowered the boom at 2:45. So Elma stood there, a little bit off to one side, balancing on the rickety blue table, waiting for the resurrection. One rickety table which Miss Floss liked to call an education. One rickety blue music table with a picture on the underneath side Jimmy Talbot drew of a jackass. They couldn't make her stand on that table, even if Jimmy Talbot did have talent, and standing was not allowed but on that one table. So Elma chose not to stand. Instead, she leaned, she balanced, she pivoted on her one foot. Her other foot was no use to her whatsoever. Every time she used it, the table twisted itself away from the wall and a little bit and squawked like a white goose. Meanwhile, Miss Floss made giant circles on the chalkboard. They were forward circles, around and around between the lines. Elma could go around and around between the lines all day. She made better circles than anyone. She wanted to make perfect circles for Miss Floss and promised she'd never talk again out of turn. But it was too late for that now. Elma pivoted on the ball of her numbing foot, and the table squawked exactly like the trap door in her mother's hotel kitchen back in Baker City. The trap door gave, it bounced, it buckled, whenever Elma and Tress used it for a jumping place. But Tress wasn't standing on the music table with Elma in the corner now. She was at her desk in the middle of the room, a big fourth grader, making circles for Miss Floss. Tress never got stars for her circles, but Elma always did. Elma had 14 stars at North Powder since second grade, and at Baker City she had 5. But in Baker City, the trap door in her mother's kitchen squawked like the music table and felt exactly the same under her feet. Only under the trap door there were real red ants that would crawl up your legs if you got put in there. They'd crawl up your legs and into your pants. Miss Floss stood at the blackboard with her back to the class, her hips moving to the rhythm of the chalk around and around. "You got ants in your pants, Miss Floss?" around and around. Miss Floss made a long spring chalk coil on the board, one long snow tunnel for Elma to crawl through. Elma made up a story that went like this. Elma crawled through the tunnel on the chalkboard, crawled back in time through the chalkboard tunnel, and fell in the lap of Mr. Thomas in Baker City. That was when Elma was still 7 and not 9, and her parents ran the Oregon Hotel. The mother and the father and Elma, with only one other sister and absolutely no brothers named Vernon and LeVar, were in the hotel business. Elma sat down on the lap of Mr. Thomas in the hotel when he was asleep. He had long, smooth gray hair and wore a holy rose coat that smelled like mice. Elma said, "What's this hole for, Mr. Thomas? You going to put a rose in there? Are you on your way to a funeral? And this hole, Mr. Thomas, on your chest and in your sleeve, what you want to carry roses all over you for?" That's what Elma said. Then the father came in and made Elma go upstairs to bed. He said, "If I ever catch you down doing that again, I'm going to smack your butt and stick you down in the hole." Then he smacked her butt anyway. The end. Elma stood on the table on her one good foot. If she made one move the wrong way, the whole thing would fall flat. Then she would say, "Thank you, Miss Floss. Thank you for my broken leg." And all the homesteaders in North Powder would say, "They had to rush the poor broken girl to Baker City, and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Elma Egg back together again." That's what they would say. Poor Elma Egg and her broken leg. Poor Elma Egg and her cracked heart. Miss Floss had gotten to the end of her tunnel. All the first graders in the first row, front row looked pleased, except Jimmy Talbot. Jimmy Talbot was only 4 1/2 and was the poorest excuse for a first grader that Elma had ever seen. He was a puny kid, but Miss Floss had begged his parents to let him come to school with everybody else in North Powder that was 5 and 6 because he had as much brains as anybody. But she hadn't let up on him since he had got there. Miss Floss said he was smart as a whip, and Elma knew he was a real genius with a piece of chalk. But at that moment, Miss Floss was looking down and pointing the white finger of the Lord right between Jimmy Talbot's eyes, and she was saying, "Right, Jimmy Talbot, right." And Jimmy Talbot was screwing up his face on a piece of blank paper. Elma stood flat-footed, but mostly on one leg. It was like standing in line for Saturday matinee. It was only a matter of time, and Elma could wait forever until the lights dimmed and the piano player started. There was no need to say, like some big-mouthed kid, "Let the show begin," because it always started whether he said it or not. That is, it started if you had a nickel. Then the serial always began, something like this. Last time we left our hero sitting in the foyer of the Oregon Hotel. Mr. Thomas had just come in from the cold. Outside it was cold, very, very cold. He had just come in to take a nap where it was warm and no one could bother him. Meanwhile, lurking in the shadows and up to no good, the father waited to throw Mr. Thomas and the other drunken bums out. The father was a dirty prohibitionist, and he said to the bums as they huddled around the stove, "You leave your dirty old liquor bottles outside or you can't come in here." And they did, too. Left them out in the snow, white ones and brown ones that smelled like mice. And Elma Egg gathered them together in a burlap sack and took them down to the street, down the street, and traded them for candy. And that's what Elma Egg did with Mr. Thomas's whiskey bottles. Then one day the evil stepsister came into town. They called her Zora because that was her name. The stepsister made cookies and wouldn't let you have any dough, so you and your real sister who never bossed you around, Tress, hid under the table, and the minute Zora's back was turned, you dipped your finger into the bowl. Zora made the cookies for the people at the hotel, said she was helping out the mother who had to do all the cooking and make all the beds, but she didn't care because she was mean, just plain mean and bossy, and thought she was in charge of telling everybody else what to do. Zora bossed at the hotel when the mother and the father weren't around, and that's the part about the wicked stepsister, Zora. Then there's the part about sneaking in. This is what you do. You come in past the wood box and you look both ways. And when the father is outside and Zora, the sister, is in the kitchen hoarding her cookie dough, you come in and sit on the lap of the man in the holy rose coat, Mr. Thomas. No one pays attention, and you keep a lookout for the father because he is the one with the stick. And you hope Zora minds her own business, but she doesn't. Zora comes through the door with the batter in her hair and throws a storming fit and tries to drag Elma out by the arm. Then Zora blabs to the father, and the father says, "I warned you," and sticks you down in the hole. But the only thing is, just before the trap door closes, Elma Egg sticks her snaky tongue out at Zora and lives happily ever after. And that's a story about Baker City and the prohibitionists and how they get people. Miss Floss is not in that story. She is right here making backward circles around the room. She's on patrol and plans to sneak up on Jimmy Talbot. Everybody knows this. Shame on you, Miss Floss. Jimmy Talbot doesn't notice and keeps playing in the inkwell. "Look out, Jimmy Talbot, look out." Elma is stuck in the corner, not talking. Then Elma forgets and puts her weight on her right foot hard. The table shudders, squawks, and soon Jimmy Talbot is looking right at her, Miss Floss coming up behind. So Elma bugs out her eyes and makes a face. And Elma's in the corner not talking, but she says, "Jimmy." It just slips out like nobody's business and changes things. Jimmy Talbot is surprised when Elma makes a face and says his name, but he is more surprised by Miss Floss. Whack for not paying attention. Whack for not doing your work. Whack for playing in the inkwell. Jimmy Talbot holds his pencil funny and doesn't look up again. Elma gets another half hour. Elma can't lean hard against the wall or the table twists out. Elma can't put all her weight on both feet because the table sinks down on that one side. Elma can't move an inch or say one word or she gets it. The legend of Elma Egg continues. Last episode found Elma Egg crouched behind the wood box, not saying a word, waiting. So she slips past the kitchen and sits on the lap of Mr. Thomas when the father and Zora are not around. The mother doesn't matter because she never says anything. Elma Egg says, "You want your hair braided, Mr. Thomas? I can braid your hair while you snore. You just go to sleep if you want. I promise I won't pull too tight. My oldest sister pulls too tight. You don't know her, Zora. She pulls like everything, pulls way back till I can't shut my eyes. But I won't pull like that, Mr. Thomas. I won't make pigtails that pop your eyes out. I'll just let them hang so. You got nice hair, Mr. Thomas. It comes apart real good. If I had a ribbon, I could put it right here. But I'll just have to wet it with my tongue." That's what the girl Elma said to Mr. Thomas, and no one interrupted. Then one day she said, "You ever get tired of people, Mr. Thomas, like when they want to boss you around, like when they stick you in the hole for talking?" But she didn't explain everything. Mr. Thomas had feelings, too. One thing you want to remember, Mr. Thomas, is to never bring your dirty, stinking liquor bottles in here. My father doesn't like that. He'll stick you in the hole, and the ants will crawl up your arms and into your mouth. You ever get ants in your pants, Mr. Thomas? You got to do what my father says, or he'll put you in the hole in the kitchen floor, and no one will ever hear from you again. He closes the trap door, and there you are in the dark with ants in your pants. They would crawl in your mouth, Mr. Thomas, and come out your eyes." But Mr. Thomas never said anything back. He just sat there snoring, smelling like mice, with his head leaning off to one side so Elma could braid his hair. On the table, Elma's toes feel like ice. She puts down her other foot, and the table rocks back and forth. Squawk, squawk goes the table as she moves around until the pins start to move in her sleeping feet. "I'm sorry," the table says. "I'm sorry you went away, Mr. Thomas. You should have kept your bottles out and your mouth shut." Miss Floss has finished with penmanship, and now she is talking about elephants. Miss Floss could talk all day about elephants. Elma wants to tell Mr. Thomas about the elephants in Zambezi. Elephants can take you anywhere you want to go like horses, only you talk to them to make them go. You say, "Down, Simba, down," or "Up, Simba, up," and that's what you say to elephants. Miss Floss is drawing an elephant on the chalkboard. It is the worst elephant Elma has ever seen, not half as good as the jackass Jimmy Talbot drew on the bottom of the rickety music table. Then something happens. Jimmy Talbot starts to laugh, and he's pointing right at Miss Floss. Just a little snicker at first, but it grows. It begins to roll across the room from face to face, an infecting doom. And when it gets to the icy windows, it bounces off and rolls back louder until the entire class is laughing, partly at Jimmy Talbot, but mostly at Miss Floss, at the fat white smear of chalk dust on her rear that is in the perfect shape of an elephant. But how was she to know, poor Miss Floss? Then the whole class watches Miss Floss throw her chalk onto the floor and bust it into a million pieces. "Stand up, Jimmy Talbot, stand up." Jimmy Talbot is really going to get it now. But Elma is on the table. What's Miss Floss going to do? She could stick him outside, but you know he'd run home. She has him by the ear. But what is she going to do? Then Miss Floss decides. She sticks him under her desk. The table says, "Don't do it, Miss Floss, don't do it." But she does it. And then she sits down at her desk to talk about elephants, on and on. Imagine Jimmy Talbot there in the dark under her legs. What's he supposed to do? Elma waits on the table, not talking. There is absolute quiet in the room except for the drone of Miss Floss's elephant voice, the sound of elephant herds from Zambezi. And right when Miss Floss gets to the part about kneel, Simba, kneel, Jimmy Talbot does what everyone has been waiting for. He pokes Miss Floss in the leg with a pin. And Miss Floss rears up her elephant trunk, shriek, shriek from Zambezi, and Jimmy Talbot gets booted out from under her desk, booted across the room. And that's when Elma Egg comes down off her pedestal of infamy, a reformed person, and up goes Jimmy Talbot, hero of all grades. But that is not the end of the story. Now Jimmy Talbot is on the rickety blue music table, and Elma Egg is free and loose on the world. What's Miss Floss going to do? With Elma's arm that she has a hold of right above the elbow, Miss Floss could just let her go back to her seat in the third row. She could do it, and no one would complain. It would be the Christian thing to do. But Miss Floss is no Christian. She's an elephant from Zambezi, brought to North Powder by the dirty prohibitionists. That's what she is. For no sooner had Elma come down off the music table than Miss Floss sticks her under the desk. And Miss Floss pulls in the chair and sticks in her legs when she sits down, and there is Elma Egg trapped in the dark with the smell of underpants and dirty feet. So what's Elma Egg going to do now? What is she supposed to think? Mr. Thomas is holding Elma Egg on his lap for the last time. She pulled his hands apart and climbed up just like always. She hooked her legs behind his knee to keep from sliding down, and she patted his rosy cheeks just like always. And then she braided, twin braids on one side. Her best work ever. Two braids, perfectly identical and the same size. Could she help it? She was so good. Then something happened which never should have happened. One of Mr. Thomas's whiskey bottles slipped out of his pants, crash, into a million pieces. Then Elma Egg said to Mr. Thomas, "What we got to do now, old man, is get the hell out of here." But Mr. Thomas doesn't want to go out. He only wants to sleep. She can see it in his face. What we got to do is crawl out right under the noses, right between their legs, and never come back again, ever. But Mr. Thomas only grunts. "I said we got to do something, Mr. Thomas, or the prohibitionists are going to ruin us forever. Wake up." And Mr. Thomas snorts and shifts in his chair, and that's when Elma Egg knows that Mr. Thomas will never do anything. He will never say he likes his hair braided. He will never open his eyes and see how pretty he is. And he will never stand up and tell her father to go to hell even once. That's when Elma Egg decides that Mr. Thomas will never amount to anything. And that's when she goes outside and upstairs and steals her father's razor knife and comes back and cuts off both those braids, right above the ears. And that's when Zora comes in and screams bloody murder. And that's when the father comes in with his stick and sees the whiskey spreading out on the floor, sees a little dribble of blood, not much, trickling down one ear. And that's when Mr. Thomas wakes up, feels the sides of his naked head, and says, "I'll be go to hell, and if there is one thing the father can't stand more than drinking, it's swearing." So he hits Mr. Thomas with a stick across his sorry back and across his sorry head, around and around. And that's when Elma Egg puts her arms up overhead to block out the circles, and after that there's absolutely no point in remembering any more of the story. The end.
Catwoman. It's Christmas, or will be in a couple of weeks, but I've been resenting it since Thanksgiving. This winter is bitterly cold already, and gray, dull metal silver with the heavy polluted inversion that plagues this valley in December and January, so that light is dim and breathing measurably difficult. Logan, our youngest son, suffers from asthma. Already we're spending nights holding him upright after he's been dosed with his prescriptions just so he can breathe. It's the worst part of winter, come earlier than usual this season, and it makes me crazy. Ordinarily, I'm a rational person. I don't like to think something as ephemeral as light, as subtle as breath, affects my performance, my mood. I'm not an expert in changes of the spirit. What I am expert in is computer-aided mathematics instruction for elementary school children. There's nothing mysterious or ephemeral about that. It's all very explainable and therefore comforting. Nevertheless, this morning when Jeffrey's Sony CD alarm rings at 6:30 a.m. and Vivaldi's Winter begins to play, I find myself wanting to stay in bed, covered with the star quilt Jeffrey's mother made for us when we married. I could stay there all day, curled up and blank to the hard weather, if I didn't have to be in my office at 8, if I didn't have to get Logan and his older brother Carter ready for school before that, if Jeffrey didn't expect me to make the bed as usual and shower with him. Our one concession to the midwinter need for intimacy against the dark. "I'll be going up north today in Bountiful," he says, soaping my breasts, my belly. "You have business with Dick?" "Dick Clark. It's really his name, but he's short and paunchy, and his hair is red, turning gray. No one says anything about his name anymore." "Give him a hug for me," I say. Helene, Dick's wife, one of my favorite people on earth, has the computer room for the month while what's-her-name has her baby. She says she's quit going to church again. "Helene? So changeable," Jeffrey says. "Dick never talks about that. Are dependable you and I still doing Coram Temple night tonight?" "I'm exhausted," I say truthfully, lathering the gray hair on his chest with the washcloth. "I'd like to come home and just fall into bed." "How long were you up with Logan?" "It was my night." "Only a couple of hours," I say, "but it's really getting old. You know what? I hate the lights. I can see them out his window, and they're just too cheery. Like those carolers that came last night? Why weren't any of them affected by the pollution? Why isn't somebody doing something about this? I hate it." We could move to Park City, Jeffrey says. I don't know about that, I say. He suggested this before. It's above the inversion. Park City is, and we both love it. But I'd have an hour's commute. It's a real catch-22. Well, anyway, let's make it a point to go to the temple, he says, his soapy hands sliding up and down my wet arms. It'll probably be good for us. I don't know about that either. But then there are a lot of things I don't know about lately. At Thanksgiving, we saw Jeffrey's mother at the nursing home. Her Alzheimer's has progressed at a dismaying pace. She wears a diaper now. She swore at the children. Damn you little thieves. Where'd you put my purse? She thumped Logan on the head with her fist. I tried to react appropriately. I told the children about her brain's deterioration, not to think of her as the same Gran they used to know. They cried, though, and it's had a peculiar effect on me. I find myself wondering about Jesus. When we explained Santa Claus to Carter, he said, "Well, then, is God real?" So much elaborate pretense for Christmas, maybe the same applies for church, he thought, with the excellent logic of childhood. Jeffrey said in emphatic answer, "Yes, God is real." I nodded, too, not just because Jeffrey and I are responsible people, but also because we feel it to be so. That is a good name for the force and intelligence behind our lives and behind all lives and happenings. I don't hesitate to say that's real. But more so since Thanksgiving, I've wondered about the necessity of Jesus, the awfulness of my not really so awful sins, my mother-in-law's hardly awful life, the need for somebody to suffer, bleed, and die for me or for anyone. Helene says, "The emphasis on Jesus as the one who takes away wrongness, that's the basis of all social ills. So-called Christians tolerate everything bad, homelessness, disease, pollution, because they figure Jesus will take care of it, so why should they?" That wasn't what Jesus was all about, Helene says. And I admit I think she's right, this heavy gray winter since Thanksgiving. It makes it so that I don't particularly want to attend the temple. It's not just exhaustion, it's also uncertainty. I'm thinking about this then, about the point of doing something I'm uncertain about and exhausted for, when Peter Hollister raises his hand. He needs help. He always needs help. "I pressed the generality key and nothing happened," he says. I press it and spring back, frightened. A human face, snarling, hands up close to the bared teeth. I press escape. Easy rescue. The picture blinks off quickly. "Go sit in the next carrel," I tell Peter, who doesn't seem to have been affected by what I saw. "The aid will help. I think that terminal works." I press the G key on Peter's keyboard again. A generality, a general principle or mathematical law by which the problem can be solved should appear, but nothing does. A short in the circuits, a shutdown between this terminal and the main computer, probably. I make sure Peter's new terminal is working, and then I jog up to the teacher carrel where the program is generated. Helene Clark occupies the padded gray teacher's chair, using the part of the program that allows her to watch the children work, one terminal at a time. "Who are you working with?" I ask. "Ben, in Carol 4, she says, pausing from punching keys to pat my arm affectionately. We've been friends for a long time. "Not Peter in 18? "No, why, is he having trouble?" "Well, I moved him already," I tell her. "Don't worry, he's in 20 now. I write a note for the maintenance people and tape it to 18. Whatever it was, they'll fix it. Later at lunch, I tell Helene about the face I saw in the screen. "Thought you saw," she says, grinning. "You're hallucinating. Too many nights up with Logan. How is he?" "He's always better in the morning," I tell her. "We can put on the humidifier, give him his prescriptions, everything. And he still needs somebody to prop him up." "Doesn't the medication work?" "The doctor said to give it 72 hours, but it's been 4 days and it hasn't done any good at all. That's the third prescription they've come up with. Maybe I should change doctors." "Oh, forget the doctors," she says. "Not in jest. Give him brandy." "Sure, Helene. Let's get the men and go out tonight," she says. "Pioneer Ref is showing a good production of Little Murders. What happened to A Christmas Carol or Miracle on 34th Street? Oh, we can't go tonight anyway. Coral Temple night." "Oh, you still do that," she says. "I haven't been for months. I just don't see the point." We make plans to go to the Repertory Theater on Friday night, weather permitting, and when I go back to the computer room, I see the note on 18 has been removed. I switch on the terminal, access the program, press the G key, the commutative property. X plus Y equals Y plus X, it says. All seems to be well. I shake my head to clear it of the memory of the snarling face as I greet the first graders. My Logan only coughs 3 times the whole hour. And there it is again, the snarling face in front of my eyes as I wait in my soft fold-down seat in the temple. Outside this warm haven, it is snowing viciously. Jeffrey called from Bountiful to say he would stay up there with the Clarks until the storm settled down. Maybe he's hearing about my hallucinations over fondue at this precise moment. Carter said, "Go ahead and go to the temple, Mom. I'll take care of Logan." And so I have, though it is against my better judgment, sliding as I must down the Murray streets, through the snow to the freeway, across the freeway, and up other streets to the Jordan River Temple, the white spired structure you can see from I-15 as you drive south to Las Vegas from Salt Lake City. I lean back while I wait my turn, glancing at the slip of paper with the name of the woman in whose name I'm doing this ceremony tonight, her date and place of birth. Serena LaPlante, 1742, Paris, France. She probably died before Joseph Smith was even born. I close my eyes. It's good to have nothing to do but wait in a quiet place for a small space of time. Behind my eyes, the snarling face, the furious face from Terminal 18 appears. And I know, how do I know this? That it's Serena. She has something to do here today, and she hates me. She hates everybody thoroughly. If I don't close my eyes, the snarling face doesn't appear. While the good sister with the lace collar reaches across to help me and my neighbors, I'm not at all afraid, but it doesn't last. Serena's story comes to me in a series of images I can't switch off, though I stand obediently and make the proper responses. Now the snarling face is covered by knotted hair. Now it bends downward, the hands with extraordinarily long fingernails covering it. The entire image is vivid red from behind, as if red were the color of a computer screen on which this image appears. I'm meant to make something of this, I know, and I pay strict attention. Serena's story unrolls, not in words and not like a dream, but like the cartoon strip sequences I program for the kids to punch up when they don't understand the words of a story problem on the computer. In the first frame, a little girl runs wild, screaming. Her life is bound up with the lives of women, caregivers who suffer her. That's the word that flashes almost subliminally. Suffer. An older woman with a gray braid and a stout, coarsely bloused bosom feeds her and holds her. Another, perhaps the older one's daughter, stays just out of reach when Serena screams and lashes out with her long, angry fingernails. Now, a flash of computer screens, of cartoon frames, Serena is a young woman on the edge. I understand this word edge to be both literal and metaphorical. Serena is on the edge, both physically and emotionally. She stands hissing on the edge of the group of young women who should have been her peers. Something is seriously wrong with her, has been wrong from the beginning. But the old woman and the younger woman and the younger one have suffered her to live, have made sure she stays alive, clean and fed, though she screams at them always and sometimes rakes their skin. The other young women call her Catwoman. I hear nothing with my ears, but I know she hisses and scratches and knots her hair with her clawing fingers. I know she dies like that. She never gets better. I'm profoundly sorry. All her life, she watches other young women marry and have children and live smooth, unbroken lives, while in her brain, her womb, are only jagged, inexpressible sensations which come out of her in screams and tearing and incomprehensible noise. Unbelievably, another computer screen flash, and only by the grace of her caretakers, she grows to old age, sitting in corners, taken care of by other women, the daughters and granddaughters of her original woman family. These younger women she treats with execration. I know that's the word I'm meant to hear, a biblical kind of word, which, like the other words in this strange, nonverbal experience, winks out almost before it registers. At her death, I realize I know, many of the young women of her town are relieved. She's been a burden to them, even if they haven't had to wash her and feed her. They've seen her and said to themselves, "We could have been like her." And she's known this too, only in converse terms. All she ever desired in all her life was to be like them. Normal. Womanly. Able to speak what she feels. Able to function properly. All parts of her body. All parts of her brain. Finally, I know she has died. Unhealed. Unloving. Unfulfilled. For me, here in the temple, it's time for almost the last response. I must have stood up at the proper times. No one has come to instruct me as to my mistakes. But I've been in Serena's life, and I'm not myself. I feel separated from everything. I stand again. Serena LaPlante, dead in 1790-something, Catwoman from somewhere in France, dead and insane, having been suffered by her women caregivers. How have I come to say yes in her name? What good can these ceremonies possibly do? I suppose it's just the same old question. Why me here and Jesus there? Serena there and me here. I do the motions as I'm instructed. We put on the special robes. They are lovely, draping in pleats from my shoulders to my feet, smoothing out flaws, covering up painful wounds. The ancient wise ones, probably including Pythagoras and perhaps also Hypatia, the only woman mathematician we know from ancient times, instructed initiates, as we are being instructed here. They believed mathematics was one way to explain the mystery of life. Mortality is so small, and whatever God is contains it and then makes it something else, something that doubles back on itself and redefines its original shape, like some topographical trick, some four-dimensional equation whose right terms change and modify for the better the terms on the left. I do the final ritual prayer for Serena, holding her past in my words and actions, changing somehow her present. Somehow I know, without knowing how I know, that Serena has listened suspiciously, cautiously, carefully from the beginning. The ceremony is done. With the other wives of my husband's priesthood quorum, I return to the dressing room, take off my special clothes, lay them in my suitcase, and get ready to go home. Something feels unfinished, and this feeling alarms me, because I know outside there's frightening weather and at home a sick child. A worker in white approaches. "Don't forget this," she says, handing me my recommend, which I have dropped. When I take it, a spark flashes between our two outstretched hands. "Strong stuff," I say. She smiles, her face a sparkling grid of wrinkles. "It's just electricity from the carpet," she explains, squeezing my arm. As I walk in my front door, Carter flies at me, half hysterical. "Logan's having another attack. I called Dad at Clark's. He's on his way home right now. He was worried about you because you weren't home yet. Come help." I sweep up Logan, who is wheezing, barely getting in enough air to make the next outbreath. I hold him in the rocker by the window while we wait for his father, turning the humidifier spray toward us as we look out into the snow, where the lights on the houses across the street are obscure, unfathomable, feathered behind the flakes. Briefly, a clear, untwisted image of Serena's face appears among the lights. Her fingernails are cut. Her hair smooth. She wears the robes of the temple. Breathing slow and deep, as if I could inspire my boys' lungs to work properly on their own, I sing a song about cradles falling. I rub Logan's back. To please me, he tries not to cough, but he can't help it. At last, we hear the muffled crunch of Jeffrey's car in the driveway. It stops before it reaches the garage. I watch him flip and slide on the ice in his haste up the front walk. He carries a thermos, which he lifts high as he bursts through the door, shouting, "Brandy!" Helene swears it will help. Together we lean over Logan, administering the hot, lemon-honeyed liquor, serious in our willingness to try anything, even this. Within minutes, Logan breathes more freely, and soon he sleeps. I'm faint with gratitude. Carter drowses on the couch. We leave him there and tuck Logan into his own bed, his head propped up on two pillows, his Mickey Mouse nightlight glowing faintly so that if he wakes, he'll know where he is. We walk hand to our own room, strip to our sacred garments, and lie warming each other under the star quilt, luxuriating in the possibility of a few hours' sleep. "Something happened at the temple," I tell Jeffrey. I whisper about Serena LaPlante, my lips close to his, watching his eyes. He's very tired. The hour's drive through the snow depletes him every time. But he listens intently, suffering me. "Mysterious," he agrees, his arms around me. "See, it's a good thing you went." We lie quietly for a long time. Then we turn toward each other, letting things work themselves out through the skin and tongue, wordless, unexplainable, all puzzlement and love.
I'm revealing my lack of organization again. I had on my calendar 11:45, and I'm so sorry to have missed Pauline's work because I love what she does. I've read a lot of it and really enjoy it. The other confession is that mine is too long. I had a choice between two, one that was absolutely Mormon and another that wasn't, and I decided to read the Mormon one even though it's 27 pages. So, Susan, what I did... Well, we'll see if I get done. But I brought extra copies in case anybody felt totally cheated. Called God on Donahue. I should say that the way I composed this, when I published Salvador with Aspen, there were a few passages that they thought would lose their audience, and I liked the passages, so I decided to write a short story where I could use them. Joseph Cullors, an old Mormon on his way to a Donahue appearance, found God at a rest stop. God was blowing dandelion seed heads over Utah's ironized sandstone. God's hair resembled the seeds he was blowing, soft, wispy, luminous. His 2-inch beard was something you'd want to snuggle against, luminous to almost radiant, in fact, but not brighter than the noonday sun because God was obviously traveling incognito. Joseph, having always believed in an anthropomorphic God, experienced a warm, revelatory sensation in his chest the second he laid eyes on the guy. Not heartburn, but something like heartburn, except peaceful. He approached God with equal parts trepidation and embarrassment, since he and his wife, Utana, had just been having a fight, this one over what to name their spirit children in the next life. "Hello," said Joseph shyly, stroking his own beard, which was dingy gray and bristly compared to God's. God turned to him, and Viola voice said, "Nice to see you, son." Evidence enough. Joseph's hand tightened on his beard as he pulled 12 hairs clean out before he knew what he was doing. He wanted to kneel, Joseph did, and to kiss those scruffy army boots God was wearing. But as an expert in supernal mysteries, Joseph understood he wasn't supposed to have figured out who this was and felt it incumbent on himself to let the Almighty keep his secret. So, though he knew God knew he knew, Joseph went along with the game. He tried to keep his voice from quivering when he said, "Can I give you a lift anywhere?" Blushing at the irony of his question, he realized this was the first time he had addressed his maker as "you" instead of "thou." Certainly, he thought he should have said "sir." "I mean, do you need a lift, sir? I know you don't need one, but I'd be much obliged," said God. Joseph understood there was purpose in this, some reason God wanted Joseph Cullors to take him to Donahue. The next problem was Utana, who was sitting in the front seat reading The Joy of Sex. Utana was near 70, but looked closer to 40. Though her hair was as short and white as her husband's, her figure didn't fit her age, and she was proud of that fact. Joseph was embarrassed by it, afraid people might assume he was starving her, refusing to let her grow old and fat, afraid they might think because she looked like that, he must be some kind of a sex fiend, which he wasn't. The sex fiend in the family was Utana, who regularly attended an aerobics class where she wore flesh-colored tights under black lace tights. She pranced around a gym floor while a singer ironically named Madonna belted out "Spank Me" from a boombox. Joseph had actually witnessed this, gone to a class at Utana's invitation and left in utter shock. Later, he said to his brother, who was stake president, "When the world is using the word patriarchy like something dirty, when the world thinks Mormons are anti-women because of this not letting the sisters hold the priesthood business, I ask you, could there be anything right about a bunch of suggestively dressed Mormon grandmas kicking up their heels and yelling, 'Spank me?' Could there be anything right about that?" His brother called Utana's actions a lack of propriety, pronounced proprietary, but seemed far more amused than disturbed. "She's basically a good woman," he reminded Joseph. "You know that." Yes, Joseph did know that, but he also knew Utana, and at this moment he was scared to death she'd say something dirty to God. Wasn't she the woman, after all, who had once opened a Sunday school lesson with "Brothers and sisters, we live in the world of the almighty dollar and the almighty orgasm"? And this, when Joseph was Sunday school president. He had had to go home from church sick that day, unable to face the curious eyes of the ward members, all silently asking just how much he knew about almighty orgasms. Utana was, in fact, the reason they were going to be on Donahue. The show's title was "Guilty Women Who Can't Get Enough and Men Who Think They've Given Plenty." Basically, they were going to talk about their sex life in front of several thousand Americans, and Utana was going to pretend she felt guilty. Joseph would never have agreed to it, but Utana told him she'd go alone if he didn't come with. So he hoped he'd be able to lend some dignity to the exhibit, maybe win a convert or two. And the $2,000 Phil was going to pay them would come in handy. One-tenth would go directly into God's pocket as tithing. Joseph liked the idea of indirectly forcing Phil Donahue to pay a Mormon tithe. While God was zipping his backpack, Joseph rapped on the car window, trying to tell Utana something important with his eyes. She rolled the window down, her mouth puckered with impatience. He flicked his head towards God, hoping she would catch on to things without his having to spell them out. Without saying a word, Utana asked him what on earth he wanted now. He moved his eyes, hoping she would follow them to the vision. "Well, Joe," she said in her Lauren Bacall voice. "What?" Joseph cleared his throat. "I've asked him," he moved his eyes significantly towards God again, "to ride with us." "A hiker?" she demanded. Joseph realized she didn't recognize her maker and was not having any revelation, and he knew it would be presumptuous of him to reveal God's identity, but it would also be presumptuous to suggest that the Almighty ride in the back seat. Utana would have to move. "Utana," he said in a soft, urgent voice, "I have invited him. Now, wouldn't you be more comfortable in the back seat where you could lie down?" her brows lifted to high suspicion. "I'm reading," she said. "I read, sitting up. You want me to stop reading this, don't you? Well, I'm sorry, but..." She started to hold the dirty book up. Joseph slapped it back down, toppling it from her hands to the floor. "Utana," he whispered fiercely, "get in the back. You can read later." He paused to muster his self-control. "It's important, honey." Her eyes softened at the endearment, which he hadn't used on her in several years. He wasn't sure where it had come from now, though he guessed God had inspired it. "All right," she said softly. Joseph turned back to God. "Why don't you, sir, get up in front with me? My wife's tired. She'll be resting in the back so you and I can chat." Still bothered him to call God "you," but in this informal conversation, he couldn't bring himself to use the more respectful words. "Thou and I can chat." He mulled the sounds in his mind. Sure enough, they sounded hokey, pretentious somehow, insincere. Utana shook God's hand as she moved to the rear. "We're not in the habit of picking hikers up, but you look honest enough, you Mormon." Joseph laughed and made a helpless, apologetic gesture. "Oh, Utana," he said, "of course he is." "Well, then," she said. "Well, then, okay, good." Laughing more fully, Joseph said, "Good is right." He almost nudged God in the ribs. When Joseph started the engine, he realized he hadn't done what he had planned to do at the rest stop. His bladder reminded him as he turned the key. Still, he felt he couldn't go back now. The journey to his destiny had begun, and besides, he was too embarrassed to mention the problem to God. Then, not 5 minutes onto the highway, he found he didn't have to go anymore. He hadn't wet his pants or anything. He suddenly just didn't have to go. It was a little miracle, and he knew it. He smiled thankfully at God, who smiled graciously back. When he thought Utana was asleep, Joseph asked God the burning question on his mind. "Sir, what do you think of the name Elroy?" This was the one he had reserved for the firstborn of his spirit children when he was a god in the next world. It had been his father's name. Joseph thought the El sounded like deity and the Roy like royalty, though Utana, who had never liked Joseph's father, deemed it just plain stupid. When he had first suggested it, she said, "Oh, goodness, Joe, it sounds Mexican, like El Dorado or El Cid. I'm not prejudiced, but it does." God smiled beatifically. "Nice name," he said. Joseph pressed his foot jubilantly into the gas pedal, then felt Utana rouse herself and sit up. "It's a stupid name," she said. "I heard you, Joe. Don't try pulling this on me. I know what you're doing, you men in cahoots. Now, given what we know of heaven, a firstborn son would have some damn special responsibilities. Good Lord, who would want to saddle him with such an asinine name as that?" Joseph's stomach squinched in on itself and went queasy. In two sentences, she had managed damn, good Lord, and asinine. He was grateful he didn't believe in a vindictive God. "Can you see it?" Utana went on. "Can you imagine mortals praying to God the Father and his son Elroy? It's a damn stupid name." "Please, Utana," Joseph whispered, his dentures clenched. God smiled tolerantly, and Joseph saw he was amused. So he smiled, too, even chuckled at Utana's cute foible. "Lord love you," said God. This love, Joseph knew, was directed to both Utana and himself. "Thank you," he said, consumed with reverence. I mean it. Thank you." He found, to his amazement, that he didn't have to pee until Las Vegas, when, predictably, God slept. They arrived at the studio with 2 hours to spare. By this time, Joseph had asked God if he'd like to go on Donahue with them. God had pretended to consider it, then said firmly, yes, I would. Joseph felt his heart burn within him. Well, he had prayed for wisdom and guidance insofar as this Donahue business was concerned. It seemed God was answering his prayer in person. The stage manager, Jerry Shelley, a pretty little redhead in tight jeans, was bustling about the studio, arranging chairs and setting plants in front of light fixtures. When Joseph introduced himself, she verified his name and said, "I hope you're not feeling nervous." "Ah," Joseph drawled, then took her confidentially aside and said they needed to talk. "Cold feet," she said. "No, not that. I've brought another guest." She raised her brows. "I'd like him to go on with us," said Joseph, gesturing towards God, who at the moment looked like a haggard but kindly old bum. "Him?" said Jerry Shelley. Joseph closed his eyes serenely. "Him." She started in on a prepared speech, explaining why just the scheduled guests were permitted to go on, but was only 3 sentences into it when Joseph cut her off. "You don't understand," he said. "This man knows everything about Utana and me. He has to be there with us, Miss Shelley. Otherwise," he drew himself to his full 5'5", "I won't go on myself, nor permit my wife to, neither." He had raised his voice that Utana heard. She pranced over. "Joe," she said threateningly, arms akimbo. "Joe, what are you doing?" Joseph made meaningful eye contact with God, and they both nodded. Then, in a voice rich with conviction, Joseph Cullors announced, "Miss Shelley, Utana, I know this will sound crazy, but this is in a mortal disguise, you understand? It's God." God moved his head in what looked to Joseph like a most dignified bow. Jerry Shelley, who Joseph sensed was probably promiscuous, gave one double take and then seemed to relax deep inside herself. Joseph witnessed this. It was like she could tell God's eyes truly saw her soul and loved it. Jerry Shelley seemed unraveled by the grace before her. Not so Utana, who only laughed. "Oh, not again," she said. "Honestly, Joe, just like that vision you had of me in the bathroom." She gave him no time to answer, but went on to describe his greatest fear.
Very city was if out said not know where the night and mass went going to Vegas. More high the name, but I hinted that that's it. Was he'll send out at this tonight. Get on, walk, pile him over and ask your son. Her health keeps here with apple of I will not need to see less serious because it held no sir house, he looks the out dog boy, the fish scouts of it. Said sent it was a flustered out, the fish sadly was me, snedded the guest, but no bit, so it's him if you will ask the rest was what you hear less serious. Why, I've now been getting some of the help for sort of come up in the day. This mean about the axe, if we're only eight, this is the race is a bit here. Not the sun, and I'll be here. I should sign this relaxed foot. I'm just getting clips of silver in it. That on top in the dark, which has knocked out of me, the emphasis. Nearly be the worst. I'll make this Marilyn ever set this. Oh, I should hear what's next. We should hear her not be defending ourselves this evening. Heard him tell well, and before him thought, "Sal, no, no, well." Val, for so plus, very sweet. Sal, with I lash him, said, "I ready, but sigh." He ain't man off the eye, but if you wet, so I'm not sick. That's it, nice, and I know it. Hard act for such no ocean, this isn't a soup. He was with an all over to them, for sight, both legs, it's such, now he knows, because he's very good, but I'm a dinner, she's. May, he'll never see how this look for such, he'll let share his dip. May. My boy, now, if your guy had helped build them on with those dogs, they're open your such possession, that's a thing now, what is Miss Cal's out? Zyre was serious, sight within the dog's out, that I have done none. That's this, you look, ask the city head, that's in the outsail, tonight, if not good, that's large possession. Hi, sir, and you lift under for how that's the means of the outfair, if you slice the mischief in the possession. Sir, skip the alvin of Miss Nathan, that's the sir, ash, and his neighbor, who I used to sit, I've been in the subs with me, she asked me that I had a little bit of fail, I share as yours, and I'm she is. And the serpent there, and the size of dog meat. And there are some soaps and said we can odds at their office, and the odd, and the misses over fear, flee, hug. And if you're their office, what for such? No, was it? Sight. The owner of this met there, it is, and the next trip the dog met, so we can odds and all work scaldy for dog side of the search now, sit up. Perhaps, sir, I wish to inquire you to the gal with. Spell's not here, but good if no, said that I wasn't at ease, but I handed it. No, see, I must have hit my feet. Waking up. Then he not out, never should listen to Betsy. Reaching it. Why, it's midnight, and off before the discovery of the wind for such foul sit. Dark, that's how you well know. For well, which is an off beat, little question of use by Amsie, yes. See, Mr. Wee House, for such mail, and lost by Amsie, but. Snap, sir, snap, the hips, so for such an off beat, see, yes. Man, the beast smashed this. Yeah, all right, and I see here, off the bag, which near, so long, which I knew, and I knew an off beat, see, yes. Dog, with bidden of an evil, and the evil fear comes of me. Now, on the sight, and that girl's look, my engine, and that he's just, and that's just me. He's you, and with us, and on his chinooks, and that's for such. I have the man down the sight, and stuff in the lights, and now who's your old look, he's always not so much up to my head, and if I had a last note, sure, and if I fall on you, only. I'm still hooking, and we know you're still one now, you're not so no effect, no drudge, be sure how to see, man, the beast, sister. But it's the foster's lie, when I feel like from the left side, if an ape will lose, look, this heck for such. That's it. Man, son. He'll get 50 lamps, doc. Christmas, I wish that we had got to have an atom of something that I'd got least should get me down there. I from the door over it, I was with me for a hundred hours, so we must sit down what we there for the Alps, or I'd miss it for such. I thought I was a wish and share it, and this was the first one that her, said Alp, and that girl, she's the way her hood. The girl put herself to a bit of us, her hands went off me. That's why I was going to do east, not for me to sue, and off me, so we'll have to we cannot just make it, but sir, left the sludge been all dark, and as he was, said Mr. Perks, the way that turned up as it. Dark, that's the child, but somebody now. What do you know? Yeah, earth. What do you mean? Yeah, earth. That's what I shit out the hill, earth. Why, but that's no reason. There came to start today, master, for the city, I'll leave his tucks of inner out, you think it's out. Well, when it's a little bit down. That's, you know, you're booking yourself as a piece of dashy. Yeah, I guess I'm all one up with it. We're in the human, dog, we're in the other us. The owl scanned in the little herbs, heard me in the upper run of the elf, and if I had upset the hen off, the cows and eats, and this, and I'm sorry, I'd been in the shade of first, scarf, will be the dog, stroke, but don't be. Well, see, that's gonna be a hell of a mess. Now, the naughty old alien cats, it's such a sin in the chase, and this elf, little vermeil, what's in the herbs, get out, get from with nine and it be, looks the one if I have a sort. Why, being back in the hill of our kids, the bars of dogs, I keep not, she had noon in the day, on, if I have an idea, which almost in a moose, and I don't want to sit down, being it must have very much to and a little leap to pass, and your elves are wasted, so what was the rest of that? No, it's nice, the only house after you was a hideous snail, and I had no elves of that. I'd say where the dog knives, and there's both, you know, I'd look at those, and I'm a rumble, and I still like to push. Not so you care where it's the shit after that, it's the house, it's the side, but scale down it, snake our as we look up it, it's the side, we threw it, and upside, I heard of us, still the piano, sits off, yeah, with this, the shot. We cannot not out, lot. Did he steal it? What if he'd have been a sick if he packers get out about it? Not a guffy so well. They got up in the booth, so they can get enough stone to be known in the room, but they were dead to get it. She was out with her, and then in a room, it was spazzed with no wish, and you could search to the hell out. No, I wish to see now, but soon the chef and sure they that. There was no room to get all that I've got by the chef. Well, we got the girls in the left and put here at the tent. We have to go from the lure, and I can't let it happen. I can see it in the girl's kind of ham, nearly grouping up. Yeah, one number's right beside us, and he was sitting in bed, it's open, but are you? Yeah, you'll feel. felt, and now he drew that all by my life, and her weeks, but her ears, as hard as I had not fell with her. Once, did I believe that her old herbs were up in a machine years, her thoughts, her fear, we were one with our power in the middle here. Her black friend, if you ever had done anything at your end, and this week, so in a girl, but you see. Why, I'm a time when I should be, I better was a week, why, and you're more health now, see, scroll, get I'd walk out, cash, there, than any of us in the girl. What her rights, if I am, is the out for a girl in her family power. My own view, my own speech, the first time I see the sister, the sister. Walk near with her meal crops, the paper. Why, I'm sick. That's how I was, Mark. My church, I was trying to flip the shelf, crops, said a kiss, you know. Far to the house, you. The name came around me, you know. The fish said, they just know it. So she worked for the open air, too. Why, I should get some more, and there, the woman, the officer, the house, I went out, the kid. Name some more, when you leave, send it. Chin it, and the sleep, and get my. More, I'll give you a red and say, you sound them a deal. So, I'll push out some pocket. Learn you started the nursery around my own, the sift, and it's a hand, but it's about what I do. Not seen on ice. And I give him a heel free. Heels the shock. Heels the ships. And the silver henny rested on yellow hang on. I the one yellow hang us. And the zephyr high hang us in his niche. And the shine of girl wound its eye for nibble. And he was surprised for sure on out for the day. I will not immerse the red, but if I found that she niche. Some rest, the hours in his jail, he lunch name of the old from us. Earth spoke of higher the cost of muscle. Yes, she wants to do with this meow, PD, when it falls, then I'll have so, but then it must. So I get must the skin, and it is me, next day, dog, or right on it. Oh, I'm so sweet, I'll ask him. I'll wear some and else, if you'll know, so scared I'm the time to be alleviated. Very, he did touch me, Gabriel. He was at station, it did touch me. Now, if she's named for a new one, she's named the time, then we'll know you. She has been lost by her from the Sarah guys, that can get with me, over there, so now, see, I won't wish me. Small, what me, finger, but all, fine, it is. If you have Mr. Lord, see, I'm not stealing it here. He'll have a dream. So, where will she have sent out of you? I just heard some announcements and show him the video. Hurry, he in it. Hurry, the neighbors. Hurry, it's his vision. Hurry, he in it. And the chef will be a sister, she's up with him. Would you be soft, you know, Mary, see, and the dog, no. Man, you're on the side, yes, it's my cow, but why? Sir, but you're here, and we'll have your fuss, and then we'll die. Yes, and then it is. Snare, and there, and we'll smirk, and then we'll die. Yet must see now, meeting of us in the dead. Snile, full of nervous. My good night, yeah. Yet you ran for the dear, but sleep, how far it's him. I'm on a fowl, and he was in the bed. Scared some young time, starts new to Max, and went to me after half with the feathers to the summer. Snobs, your child looked home out of me, still with my stinnery. He ain't roof. Boy, full of nut. Never nut. Boy, he nut. The odds are he's showing out, I'll know. Yeah, breakfast there, a hot. He'd all breakfast there, a hot. The other power from shim off with a little bit. Boy, if he still keeps it, we'll be it. He'll no moon. No moon. My belly, but so well, they're haunted, rouses, they're about each hall. Some rest serve not me, and look. Roosts in one's each neck. Her family, but if it's lost, and mother's death, and her honey's sick. Ready, and her shawl, with nothing of a head, and a beat, mother's finger of minutes each. He can be rotten, I should have been a man while you'd been in. Why, now, the alley, we're outside, and her hat. Sir, it's a bit real, keeps home off, glass, and you. Snare, it's still a bird, non-engineer, it's in this girl, with a yell, she'll. You're open now, go COVID, but hurry, he's no matter what's that on ya. Some sheriff is cut up, see if she's never worn my seat. You might have never worn to the roof, but Sir Odd and I are not Sir Odd. Never wear the alvarish nigga. Sir, no, nigga, it is. She had a lot of service. Sir, if you're a sheriff, it's here, but I'll be wanting it. Child, New York City, she's better than it. He'll be living up. See, I'll be with my hair mocking in it. And you're a sheriff, and that's New York, it's near what I'm up to. And she has a nice little bit of skin it. The guy's been a lot of move. And the air burr, and they allow, swell, and the curb not doing swill, and they're blushed by an ear, and the moon later, that's just how we shall be hot. Here, I'll seal my curb now. For that's the revenge. That tells the odd, be showing ya. Sir, me from y'all, for the way her sound, that the sharks, and that's the he showing ya, the sir, I'm filling it under ya. And the moon, that you're hot, and the moon later, that you. Make sir, it scares me, I must not say I want, but the New York, he should, dive, and that new. The all of the Etsy sure shame, but I was your first fan over my unit. And over my unit, and I'm a boy, and I give him a more and exact. Her hand on real serious singing, it must. Sir, I keep her head with a shoe, and I'm a way to prove it was day not. And Etsy, and I Etsy, they want to show him in that ill because it touched day not as any risk. Well, Carl, put him that or a little hobby, but she died, it'll say that's her now. She day not, and I'm a way to any risk. Some air from New York, some air, sir, even for shelter. Why? Why, and if you're getting older, it was a child, and that's in New York, it's in your no fear, but I'd say it's, her odds, no, it's fire, her then, her slow, and her sleep, under snow assaults, and the child gets her down sleep. What must have missed out now, will have a kid who's not out of us this hand, but you have experienced this nowhere, give us the hours you can't have him down it, so it's nail a high, but lots of cities don't so well. He had the showers, the very yes, of cities, you get his kid, and the shoe will see the sense of more, and I am if you're ready, I'm lost in the shirt block was. So it will show us all this is here, but not. And my real was guess behind was this is easy now, this is made. It's near. No, we never frame or fad. The old brass city, I must have been. Fad, we'll hot, you'll draw down there, the mem. Snis will hot, was he'll run on this and we'll hot it. Says he's made a session, and I better know about and it's in this was room. Step. Well, your side is, yes, as I know that. I'm going to find this valor now, he's in valor right now, he's in the lesson in a stroke for the command to visit out. Well, see, but still, if he was a kid, was hot up, well, people was not sit around, your fresh, the kids are done, loosed it on now. Well, you're sitting out, excited, you're snaking, I've minute, that's your fish. The last book is now, almost got you to, fish your strips out, when you're sitting in some circus, and I see your badlish numbers. Well, your dogs, and I've always seen your dog, it's all good, nice, and you'll see him. Says he's diving your nose, plus him now. I'm not got fear, you should be fresh, and what the dark kid. One to see in there, miss, it's there, but get this down. And the sherry receipts in the air, but I've been a blush to blush, I'll air for, but I read out now. It's safe for the way, and on a well to my fish. Sir, if I'm the fish, no, sweet, fully nice, and they're blush to their old fish. Why, and her fat is her wish. See, I'm the amps, it's the sour grips, it's her mass lara. I'm on his turn, it's her thumbs, your fish, that's young, it makes me get. He'll be alive, but why doesn't it fit, I'll learn that the... Or the diet, I bone on it. Sir, if you be a bliss, Marada, well, I didn't find it out, and I hate what's this, I see hope my sister dog is young, but against the little, you know. We've seen how much I feel, was the stream mixer, I never had it. Developed up, and was a this girl. And the sheriff made the bubbles to her old feet, said, this is your sea, excuse me. Yes, that's I want to. So I see if I need this girl, but when did you? Steady a hat, so if I bring it, must know, indeed, I must say, I'm sure, but I'll be careful, I've been in her well. Down, sound me, it's real, or I should help. Here is, you should, sister, though, I know that I'm a decent cat. Yeah, I'll be here. That when it's long and a healer said a bit, says her, I will put him up. Yeah, now I'm so weak. I'm not going to play your mama. And I've been no officer no more, my child. I'll show with those sessions in our hair, the mirror that I'll heal with your face, yeah, that's how it's going up. Yeah, understand what my smirk knows, let's see, I know you'll be next to drop. So if I was caught your vengeance, so that's your fresh pull, but me ashes. Yeah, look. I'm not just your stone, but you'll see, she's. He'd ever say, man, or so out, and I'm with my rouge, make it sister, and I'll be for a fam for no fowls getting ill. Yes, I am over the hum of it. Her only man said, I'm going to say, as this knowing, hair, and inner stairs, the rest, and he's not my girl, she'd have man sailors, and girl, good. Okay, so since it's like, he'll have them, sire, bamming it was, says he'll have an eye of the head, throwing bingo, goodbye. Broad, it's my gay symphony, your fingers, no dim, but it's chest, and know where I, might be where I should. Oh, she said, I'd be scamming him, got skinned the deer fish, but either old people looks her feet over her, or their brittles in it, and the glow leg is tightened it up. She ate this if I am, they be tightened it up. Her the older husband yelled, and the fiddler, yeah, Laura, that's the gun. There ain't been no sorrow, damn her, them zero fish, low crotch, sit to her, but dad, nay, it's just me, no, plus him now, pal. Yeah, but it's naive, her, it's new. See, love, even in my ear, it's just this near my lady, seen what's seer fish, knowing in her own sits, I love her, but. Get her from my girlfriend, though, when I'll scare it, lost it. That's I belong my first, so you reach some get answered. Nervous looks, you're snail, I'm from scratch, and skin, I'm time to dare to mix in a drip sky, my auto. Very psit, this is me, and drip sky, and on my. Do the mams, number one, for fam, sky, fire, zilda, set, steal, zilda, or my fizzing, it must get the scant one. And the surf won't shire, my larynger. He's here, he's skimming. And as he said, well, she neither you or a muck, there's no better officer, Woodson. The ear of Mickey was such and the spricks are sit up so I'd nibs ear fat the hour from and get lost down and nips or we don't. I'm sorry, I'm a surface. And that's the thing I grant and I will. Clock of Fidel Berge, I'm a dear of them, I'd see out of it. Here we nation your mess and nail, I've said scalp and the sheriff and did we look me by hit the word of this what I'm what the air of me, I'd rod lock killer dibs, there's no sit. I've experienced this thing is nice, you're not better. Skill will fucking able to run. Some circus. And I'm old, I.
To the own minute, and you remember, when you look at the kind of slow curse that I called, but they hear wolf was mouth. Here's the game of my no sadness.